get the other two questions.
Hi, Nico. Thanks a lot. I was just wondering, do you think that there's a potentially a good reason, or we could make a case for also boycotting Egypt as well for their, you know, continued blockade of Gaza?
Thank you. I'd like you to elaborate on, I thought the BDS movement was a little bit more limited in its targets and just wanted to boycott a limited number of things according to the original book, and you're suggesting a wider boycott. Could you elaborate on that issue?
Sure. You want to bring maybe the mic back?
Yeah, sorry.
Thanks. I think there's another mic there for the Q&A.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, people want to line up, but there's too much mics over here. So you have a question, you can line up.
I think that was the plan.
You're able to get up to one of those.
Well, these are rather easy questions. Thank you. I never wore the button in Tel Aviv. What I did do last time I was in Palestine, I flew. I wore a T-shirt, a black T-shirt that had big, big white letters, Boycott Israel. And I thought, okay, let's see what happens. I mean, they can't stop. They can stop me, but they can't deny me entrance. I'm a citizen. Now, when you get off the plane, if you flow in Tel Aviv, when you get off the plane, you go through this long corridor, and they have these agents looking, and they're looking for the, you know, the activist types or somebody who's dark, you know, maybe Arabs. I walk right past them. I think it's a little bit like the story. You know, they tell the story that when Christopher Columbus came with his ships, that the Indians didn't see them because they didn't know things like that existed. I don't think the way I look and the T-shirt I wore matched their impression. So I walked right past them and nothing happened. So, you know, I tried. Nothing happens. But no, generally speaking, because I have citizenship and because the apartheid is very, very effective and very deep, as an Israeli Jew, they really can't deny me. They can hold me, they can arrest me, but which they never have. When I travel, I go in and out very easy, very easily.
They denied the rabbi from JVV.
They're not Israeli citizens.
What if she was going to make Aliyah?
Well, she should. In fact, I've been encouraging Jewish activists to make Aliyah so that they can go there and cause trouble. And I have one friend who's in the process. She's trying. So we'll see what happens. But yeah, until you're a citizen, they can deny you. But as a citizen, so far, as a Jew, they... boycotting Egypt is not a bad idea, but it's a little more problematic. I'll tell you why. In my opinion, anyway. Israelis vote in very high numbers, Israeli Jews. The Israeli government and its policies represent the will of the Jewish people. They vote in very high numbers. The makeup of the government, the makeup of the Knesset, represents the people, and it's not a pretty sight. So when we boycott, we're boycotting not only the government and the state, but the people who voted for them. They could vote for somebody else. Israelis could be in the streets, blocking the highways, demanding that people in Gaza receive water. They could. Some might be arrested, some might be ruffled up, but they don't, you know, they're not going to shoot us. We're Jews. Never happens. There's a handful of activists going from protest, from village to village to village to protest. The same handful of protesters. Never happens. So we're boycotting not just the state, not just the policies, but there's something deeper here. This is Israeli society. You know? Egypt had elections. Israel and America didn't like it. The Egyptian military didn't like it. They had a coup, and now they have a coup leader, a dictator, who's running Egypt. He's not representing anyone but himself, and he gets all the foreign aid money that goes to his pockets. It's a slightly different situation. So it's perhaps something that needs to be looked into, but I wouldn't want to punish the Egyptian people for something that the dictator that Israel and the U.S. propped has decided to do. So it's not exactly the same thing. In terms of BDS limits and what the BDS movement focuses on, so there's two issues here. You go to the BDS movement.org, I believe it is. You go to the website, you see the campaigns, you see specifically what they're campaigning and what they're putting their efforts into as a movement. As an individual, I believe everything should be boycotted. So I'm not going to buy Israeli products. The two don't contradict. You've got the larger campaigns, which are extremely important and have been very successful, take time, take a lot of, they're well thought out, require a lot of discipline. And then you've got the day-to-day stuff, the couscous, the hummus, the shampoo, and all that kind of stuff, which we just boycott, we just don't buy, you know? So those are, they don't contradict. This is really all, it's the same thing, okay? Any other questions?
There was a question. Did your question get answered?
Yes.
Okay. So, I'll pass this around, I'll bring it back, okay?
You don't want to use that one?
All right. Anyone else? A couple more people?
Just line up behind the mic, and then you can just...
The two of you can come forward, either this side or that side.
Since, as you say, it's really...
Get a little closer.
The Israeli people who do not see the Palestinians as full human beings, and they don't see themselves... as responsible for what is happening, and they keep voting for these people. I'm almost done.
Okay, I gotcha.
How do you see things going eventually when apartheid drops and the Israeli and Palestinian people live together in a democracy? I'm just I worry about that because, you know, there has to be a big change in the minds of the people, and I'm interested in how your mind got changed, because I think that could really, that's, okay, good. I think that's the important story, because, yeah, that's what has to happen.
Yeah, thank you for that.
Don't worry, is that one?
Yeah, who else?
Two please. Over here.
My name is Julie. Thank you for everything that you talked about.
Sure.
You made a little offhand comment about people moving to make trouble. I'm actually moving to East Jerusalem on Thursday.
Are you Jewish?
I'm Jewish, and I'll be doing anti-occupation work with an organization. And I was wondering what suggestions you had for people that are not boycotting but are going to do work on the ground.
What's the organization?
Asbat Amin.
We have a third question. Anyone else?
Yeah, quick question. What do you think about Ben & Jerry's still there in West Bank? What would you do about it?
Okay. The first question is the tough question. So, what do you do after decades when you have two societies that live in this reality and you're trying to create, you know, a democracy? Well, I think South Africa presented us with a really good model. Truth and Reconciliation Commission did some really important work. And there were other things, you know. And it's not a simple thing. It's not easy but by any stretch of the imagination. But in South Africa, you had two very different groups. You know, you had, you know, 40 million impoverished blacks and, what, 3-4 million privileged whites. In Palestine, first of all, Israelis and Palestinians are very similar. Education levels are very similar, very high. The reason there's unemployment and poverty on the Palestinian side is because of the economics of oppression and apartheid, but the difference is it's not that great. It's not this total, you know, poverty like exists in South Africa. Most Israelis are actually Arabs. Most Israelis are actually Arabs because most Israelis are the descendants, children and grandchildren of Jews who came from Arab countries. So they listen to Arabic music at home. In fact, one of the most popular bands in Israel is a Yemenite band that sings in Arabic. The majority of Israeli Jews are Arabs, Arab Jews. Now, Arab Jew is not something that they would call themselves because Arab is bad and Jew is good. So there's a process there. But when you talk to the grandchildren of Jews who came from Morocco, they say, we are Moroccan. And the Yemenites say, we're Yemenites, and so on. And the Syrians say, we're Syrian, and so on and so forth. So they're not that different. You know, what makes them different, what put the wedge between, you know, really Jews and Arabs, is Zionism. It's the system of inequality. It's the apartheid regime. It's what Zionism brought to Palestine. So I expect the transformation into a, you know, into a peaceful coexistence is going to be much easier and much quicker because of these things. Now, another thing is, South Africa, for example, is a single voting district. It's a massive country. It's a single voting district. Israel is also a single voting district, and one of the things that does is it allows them to all these manipulations where the minority has no political vote, even though they vote. There's been talk in Israel for a very long time by Israeli Jewish politicians to create voting districts. Now, you probably will be able to create a few, but most voting districts will not be able to be ethnically pure because the communities are too close. So now you have an Israeli and a Palestinian voting together. Are they going to vote for... Are they going to vote based on ethnic considerations, based on ethnic considerations, or are they going to vote based on their mutual interest, which is low taxes and good schools and good roads? Some would probably still vote along ethnic lines, but I think the majority would vote for the low taxes and good roads. You know, and that's another way to bring people together, because it's a small country, and the communities are geographically very close. You know, now I'm not suggesting this is easy at all, but I think but I like our chances of success. And again, I think it's important to also, in this context, to see that the end of the apartheid regime is the beginning of the road. In other words, as long as there's a state of Israel, there cannot be peace, there cannot be peaceful coexistence, there cannot be justice, they will never free the prisoners, they will not end the siege on Gaza, and they will never allow the refugees to return. For those things to happen, and these are crucial elements, none of these are negotiable. There has to be the falling of the apartheid regime and a new state created. Okay? That is the beginning of the road. It's not the end all. That's not, you know, Gardner, that's not like paradise. That's the beginning of when we start to work together. Israelis and Palestinians can start working together. That's that point. And that's when people will change their mind. People change their mind the day after. You know, like I said, South Africa apartheid didn't fall because whites suddenly became saints. They fell because they had no choice. They were hit on the head hard enough. They went on their knees and they had no choice. Israelis will do the same thing. And the next day, they have an Israeli prime minister, they'll have a Palestinian prime minister, perhaps. And their kids are going to go to school, Palestinian kids, and they'll have a teacher or a principal who's Palestinian. And the sky's not going to fall. And they're going to go to work, and the kids are going to go to school, and, you know, you move on. You know, so that's the reality. The reality forces us to change. People don't change on their own. My reality, you know, again, like I said, I pointed the stories in the book, but I'll give you like the 60-second version. Tragically, I think, as human beings, we only change as a result of something terrible happening. That's kind of the way we are. In my case, my sister's little girl was killed in a suicide bombing. She was 13 years old. That was the beginning of my journey. You know, until then I was pretty detached. So, you know, I don't think God forbid anybody would have to go through something like this as well. But people change when they don't have a choice, when they're faced with a reality where they have to look elsewhere. And I think, like I said, I don't want this to happen to everybody, every Israeli, but I think the day after this is going to work. They have to change because they will not have a choice. You know, if they don't want to live with Arabs, they need to go back to Europe or something. You know, like Helen Thomas said one time. If they don't like it, they can go back. Julie, was your question about, like, what to do when you get there, what to do at the airport? I mean, what exactly are you asking about?
I'm wondering about, like, organizations that you suggest, or,
Well, it all depends on what you want to do. I think Palestine is a very friendly place. You go to Ramallah, you're going to meet the nicest people, the best activists. In an hour, you're going to know people. You're going to know people you can stay with, people you can protest with, people you can write with, somewhere where you can do... you're going to know everything, you know, because it's that kind of a society. It's very friendly. If you're on the Israeli side, it's not quite as open and friendly because they're not open to that kind of thing that much. But once you're there, it's going to be very easy. You know, you go to, you probably heard of Bilayin, you know, where they have protests every Friday. If that interests you, if that's something you want to do, you go there, you're going to meet so many people, you start talking, they know what you do, you know what they do, and things start. So once you get there, you're going to get a really good idea of where you want to go and what you want to do.
Do you think it's necessary that there are people also going to
I think it's important to do everything that can possibly be done. You know, it's more like a Parthenon rather than a single pillar. You know, there are the weekly protests, there's the popular resistance, there's the popular, you know, the popular resistance movement, there's BDS, there's, you know, people writing poems. There's lots of different things. People who are, you know, blogging, there's lots of important stuff that's being done. What exactly is going to tip everything, we don't know. Every little push helps. You know, obviously BDS is a big component, but there are a lot of components and there's lots of things that can be done and should be done. Absolutely, yeah. Does that answer your question? Okay. Ben and Jerry's, you know what, I don't know enough about it to say, but I don't want to comment. I know there's some issues about Ben and Jerry's, whether it's still owned by Ben and Jerry's. I think it's owned by a different company, so I'm not really familiar with it that much, but I'm sure if you go online you can find the information.
Okay, three more questions.
Wrap it up.
What's that?
Three more and we'll wrap it up?
Yeah. Okay. So, okay, there's two people here and
we can do four.
A friend here.
We can do four. Go ahead, please.
Okay, real quick. I just want to know, have you considered this and looked at it and noticed it? And that is how in these situations that Palestine is in with being occupied, the person that's being occupied, the people that are being occupied, often they fight in a way that allows them to be institutionalized. Then we have institutionalized colonization, where you have to fight for the things that are already yours. You fight for this, you fight for that. There's the colonizer saying, you can't have this, it's mine, even though originally it was yours. So you fight for that. And that's where you have institutionalized colonization, institutionalized racism, and it becomes very hard to overcome it. And I want to say one more thing, that there's plenty of South African leaders who are saying South Africa is not free. So thank you.
So I'm not sure what your question is.
Yeah. Okay. Are you concerned? Because I can already see that I'm sorry, I'm a little overcome here, but the Palestinians are choosing ways to fight their battles that are creating institutionalized racism or colonization, where they're not really going to be free. They're going to have to fight for the very things they should already have and pay attention to rules created by the colonizer, their courts, their rules, their schools,
yeah, that is the
their
reality.
System, and then you can't overcome that. And I should know.
Okay. Okay, what's the other question, please?
Second question here, and then a third question.
Okay, I'm wondering when Palestine is free, do you think that all these imperialist wars against countries in the region, Iraq, Lebanon, Syria, Iran, Libya, Sudan, etc., do you think those kinds of wars will stop because those wars are partially perpetrated in order to protect the Zionist colonialism in Palestine? And secondly, do you think that there's a possibility that Palestine will become part of a more larger, more unified Arab nation?
Question number three.
I want to say thank you for being such a powerful force for peace and of this conflict. You seem to be directing BDS at changing Israeli institutions, Israeli companies, Israeli society. I wonder if you could just say a few words about what can be done to change the attitude of American Zionists toward our own government and the government of Israel.
Okay. The first question, I agree with you about the institutionalized colonialism, but that is precisely... I can't see her. Is she here?
She wasn't able to stay.
Oh, she had to leave.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. It's a complicated question, so we can move on. I mean, institutional colonization is exactly the problem. Of course, we always play by the rules of the colonizer. That's the reality. And what Israel does is, you know, you may have heard there was a hunger strike, prisoner hunger strike. There were 1,500 prisoners on a very long hunger strike. And what Israel does, it creates conditions that are so severe, and it forces the Palestinians to put in an enormous amount of effort in order to get just a little bit back. So in the case of the hunger strikers, for example, their demands were simple. A little more visitation, some more phones, you know, things like that. 45 days of hunger strike. That's an enormous price to pay. It's an enormous price to pay. What they got was, instead of once a month for 45-minute visitation, twice a month, an hour and 15 minutes. Now, one Israeli attorney described what the passage is like, the journey from a Palestinian town to an Israeli jail. He said he compared it to what it was like for somebody who lives in Paris to go to Devil's Island to visit somebody who's imprisoned on Devil's Island. He called it mountains of restrictions and oceans of permits that they need to go through. And once they overcome the restrictions and they have the permits, the journey is insane. It's 2-3 days sometimes. And there's no guarantee that they're going to get in, because maybe there's a lockdown, maybe they misbehave, maybe they just don't feel like letting them in. They went from 45 minutes once a month, to an hour and 15 minutes twice a month. That's worse than what prisoners here in America get. When I visited the guys I wrote about, you get to sit, you know, one day a week, you know, you can sit from 9 to 3. Which is not a lot, but, you know, you make that enormous effort to go somewhere, at least you have a day to sit with them. And, they're not my family. Can you imagine loved ones? So they put in an enormous amount of effort. And I think they got a few more minutes of, you know, phone time. Maybe a couple more, you know, pay phones. Very, 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 very small gains. And it was presented as a great victory, you know, because, you know, such efforts, you don't want to present it as though it was nothing. But that's the reality, and it's true. You play by the rules that are forced upon you. You know, we were in Hebron. I'm in Hebron a lot. A new checkpoint is being built. Now, the checkpoints are between Palestinians and Palestinians. It's just to make life harder for Palestinians. Who do you think is building the checkpoint? Palestinians. Palestinians, and it's a construction company from Ramallah. And we're looking at them. I took a picture. They said, no pictures. I said, you don't want pictures? What are you doing here building a checkpoint? Well, that's their livelihood. Palestinians built every home. Every Jewish home in Palestine was built by Palestinians. They do the construction forever. Every place, every Israeli town, every Israeli city, every Israeli home was built by Palestinians. They built everything. They built the reality in which they live. That's the sad reality they rely on the colonizer for work, for their livelihood. That's part of the problem. When Palestine is free, I don't know what's going to happen, but I suspect that a free Palestine and the end of the Zionist intervention in other countries will bring many good things to other Arab countries, because many of the Arab dictators are there because Israel and the U.S. are supporting them. They're not there because of the will of the people. And so when that support doesn't exist, I think a lot of these guys are just going to take their billions and run to whatever, Switzerland or whatever country is going to take them, which will hopefully bring about, you know, a better life for their people. But who knows what's going to happen? A larger Arab nation, they tried. I don't know that that's a realistic expectation. And again, a lot of the people there are not Arabs. So I don't know if that's going to work. How to change America, how to change the U.S. government and Zionism in America? You know, the only reason America supports Israel, they talk about shared values, which is nonsense. They talk about the, you know, allies and mutual interests. The only shared values are racism and violence. That's the values that the U.S. and Israel share. If it wasn't in Israel, if it was a different government, I mean, the Egyptians are buying weapons, the Jordanians are buying weapons, the Saudis are buying weapons, everybody's buying weapons. So, I mean, Israel has a very effective lobby. Not only here, in every single country there's an Israeli lobby that does incredible work. And it started with my grandfather's generation. I talked about it in the beginning. Very white, very clean, highly educated, very presentable, and they make the case. And it's not lobbying, you know, a bunch of people in suits sitting around, you know, members of Congress office in D.C. It's not that. It's every community. It's every school book. It's how the whole narrative of Palestine is described. You know, people here in America argue over whether creationism or evolution need to be, you know, to be taught. That's a big debate, right? Look at what is taught about the Middle East. It's all biblical. You know, my kids took AP World History. The entire chapter on the Middle East is from the Old Testament. King David, king this, king that. There's no historical proof that these people existed. Abraham, Moses. Fine, it's a book of faith and everybody believes, that's fine. I mean, that's a book of faith. High school AP history book, world history, is biblical. You know, they got the source is the Old Testament. As taught as history. We have a long way to go before creationism and evolution is that issue. And that's where it starts. You know, Jewish millionaires and billionaires, philanthropists doing great work, donating, giving, and there's always a line there about how Palestinians are terrorists and supporting Palestine is anti-Semitism and how we always have to support Israel because they're our friend. There's a program when I was in Dallas a few years ago in the public schools where the ADL goes in and creates what they call a tolerance environment. And the school gets a certificate saying that they're a tolerance school or tolerant whatever something school, certified school. So they teach about racism and about equality and da-da-da-da-da. And by the way, anti-Semitism and Palestinian terrorism is part of the program. Palestinian resistance is not terrorism. It's not terrorism. But it's in there. That's how the lobbying works. It's very deep. It's in every city. Every city council member in America gets an invitation to visit Israel. City council members, small city council members, never mind members of Congress, senators, members of city council. You know how many billions and billions of dollars they spend on this? And they go. And I remember I lived in San Diego, a small city near San Diego, and one of the city council members, it's a small town, they're volunteers. It's a volunteer position. They have other jobs. She sent me an email. She said, look, we got this wonderful invitation to visit Israel. What do you think? I said, the itinerary is wonderful. You get to go in a helicopter with some general and see the Golan Heights, and you travel throughout the country, and it's all paid for, and it's wonderful and exciting, but you want to know what they're not going to show you? And she said, yes. I said, are you sure? This is what they're not going to show you. They invest billions, and they start very, because this city council member might run for a state legislature one day. And who knows, they might run for Congress. Now they got them. You don't have to teach members of Congress to support Israel. They know that that's what you got to do to get elected. That's what you got to do to get elected. That's where the money is. So, you know, supporting Israel is like a tax. You got to do it. They don't care about it. They got to do it. So we need to change the conversation. We need to change that. So if you want to get elected, you do not support Israel. Anyone who supports Israel does not get reelected. That's the reality that we need to create. No one else is going to do it. So that's how we change it. Okay, thank you all so much. Appreciate it. Thank you for coming.
Yeah, thanks again for everybody for coming tonight. We want to thank Jill Stein for coming, for being a special guest. And, of course, Miko. He's got books in the back there. These books are especially good books and tells a very, very important story. And if you're not going to buy one, at least look at it. Look at the table of contents and everything there, but they're available here.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming. Good to see you.
Oh, yeah. No, I won't have time to do any editing or processing.